and introduced, and the general atmosphere became more relaxed. I was surrounded by a number of Highland gentlemen who took turns exchanging words of welcome with me as Jamie chatted with someone named Graham, who seemed to be Lord Lovett's cousin. The taxmen eyed me with a certain amount of reserve, but were all courteous enough, with one exception. Young Simon, much like his father in squatty outline but nearly 50 years younger, came forward and bowed over my hand. Straightening up, he looked me over with an attention that seemed just barely this side of rudeness.
"Jamie's wife,
he asked. He had the slanted eyes of his father and half-nephew, but his were brown, muddy as bog water.
"I suppose that means I may call you niece, does it not?"
He was about Jamie's age, clearly a few years younger than I.
"Ha-ha," I said politely, as he chortled at his own wit.
I tried to retrieve my hand, but he wasn't letting go. Instead, he smiled jovially, giving me the once-over again.
"I'd heard of you, you know," he said. "You've a bit of fame through the Highlands, mistress."
"Oh, really? How nice." I tugged inconspicuously. In response, his hand tightened around mine in a grip that was nearly painful.
"Why? I've heard you're very popular with the men of your husband's command," he said, smiling so hard his eyes narrowed to dark brown slits. "They call you Nio Jemimila, I hear." "That means Mistress Honeylips," he translated, seeing my look of bewilderment at the unfamiliar Gaelic.
"Why, thank you," I began, but got no more than the first words out before Jamie's fist crashed into Simon Junior's jaw and sent his half-uncle reeling into a pie-crust table, scattering sweetmeats and serving spoons across the polished slates with a terrific clatter. He dressed like a gentleman, but he had a brawler's instincts. Young Simon rolled up onto his knees, fists clenched, and froze there. Jamie stood over him, fists doubled but loose, his stillness more menacing than open threat.
"No," he said evenly. "She doesna have much Gaelic, and now that you've proved it to everyone's satisfaction, you'll kindly apologise to my wife before I kick your teeth down your throat."
Young Simon glowered up at Jamie, then glanced aside at his father, who nodded imperceptibly, looking impatient at this interruption. The younger Fraser's shaggy black hair had come loose from its lacing and hung like tree moss about his face. He eyed Jamie warily, but with a strange tinge of what looked like amusement as well, mingled with respect. He wiped the back of his hand across his mouth and bowed gravely to me, still on his knees.
"Your pardon, Mistress Fraser, and my apologies for any offence you may have suffered." I could do no more than nod graciously in return before Jamie was steering me out into the corridor.
We had almost reached the door at the end before I spoke, glancing back to see that we weren't overheard.
"What on earth does Nio Jemimila mean?"
I said, jerking on his sleeve to slow him. He glanced down as though I had just been recalled to his wandering attention.
"Ah! Oh, it means Honeylips, all right, more or less. But..." "It's no your mouth he was referring to, Sassenach,"
Jamie said dryly.
"Why, that—"
I made as if to turn back to the study, but Jamie tightened his grip on my arm.
"Cluck, cluck, cluck," he murmured in my ear. "Dinna worry, Sassenach. They're only trying me. It'll be all right."
I was left in the care of Lady Frances, young Simon's sister, while Jamie returned to the library, shoulders squared for battle. I hoped he wouldn't hit any more of his relatives. While the Frasers were, on the whole, not as sizable as the Mackenzies, they had a sort of tough watchfulness that boded ill for anyone trying something on in their immediate vicinity. Lady Frances was young, perhaps 22, and inclined to view me with a sort of terrorised fascination, as though I might spring upon her if not incessantly placated with tea and sweetmeats. I exerted myself to be as pleasant and unthreatening as possible, and after a time she relaxed sufficiently to confess that she'd never met an Englishwoman before. Englishwoman, I gathered, was an exotic and dangerous species. I was careful to make no sudden moves, and after a bit she grew comfortable enough to introduce me shyly to her son. A sturdy little chap of 3 or so, maintained in a state of unnatural cleanliness by the constant watchfulness of a stern-faced maidservant. I was telling Frances and her younger sister Aileen about Jenny and her family, whom they'd never met, when there was a sudden crash and a cry in the hallway outside. I sprang to my feet and reached the sitting-room door in time to see a huddled bundle of cloth struggling to rise to its feet in the stone corridor. The heavy door to the library stood open, and the squat figure of Simon Fraser the Elder stood framed in it, malevolent as a toad.
"You'll get worse than that, my lass, and you make no better job of it," he said.
His tone was not particularly menacing, only a statement of fact. The bundled figure raised its head, and I saw an odd, angularly pretty face, dark eyes wide over the red blotch deepening on her cheekbone. She saw me, but made no acknowledgement of my presence, only getting to her feet and hurrying away without a word. She was very tall and extremely thin, and moved with the strange, half-clumsy grace of a crane, a shadow following her down the stones. I stood staring at old Simon, silhouetted against the firelight from the library behind him. He felt my eyes upon him, and turned his head to look at me. The old blue eyes rested on me, cold as sapphires.
"Good evening, my dear," he said, and closed the door.
I stood, looking blankly at the dark wooden door. "What was that all about?" I asked Frances, who had come up behind me.
"Nothing," she said, licking her lips nervously. "Come away, cousin."
I let her pull me away, but resolved to ask Jamie later what had happened in the library. We had reached the chamber allotted us for the night, and Jamie graciously dismissed our small guide with a pat on the head. I sank down on the bed, gazing round helplessly.
"Now what do we do?" I asked.
Dinner had passed with little to remark, but I had felt the weight of Lovett's eyes on me from time to time. Jamie shrugged, pulling his shirt over his head.
"Damned if I know, Sassenach," he said. "They asked me the state of the Highland Army, the condition of the troops, what I knew of His Highness's plans. I told them, and then they asked it all again. My grandfather is no inclined to think anyone could be giving him a straight answer," he added dryly. "He thinks everyone must be as twisted as himself. We had a dozen different motives, one for every occasion."
He shook his head and tossed the shirt onto the bed next to me.
"He cannot tell whether I might be lying about the state of the Highland Army or no, for if I wanted him to join the Stuarts, then I might see as how things were better than they are, where if I didn't care personally, one way or the other, then I might tell the truth. And he doesn't mean to commit himself one way or the other until he thinks he knows where I stand."
"And just how does he mean to tell whether you are telling the truth?" I asked sceptically.
"He has a seer,"
he replied casually, as though this were one of the normal furnishings of a Highland castle.
For all I knew, it was.
"Really?" I sat up on the bed, intrigued. "Is that the odd-looking woman he threw out into the hall?"
"Aye. Her name's Masri, and she's had the sight since she was born. But she couldn't tell him anything. Or wouldn't," he added. "It was clear enough she knows something, but she'd do naught but shake her head and say she couldna see. That's when my grandsire lost patience and struck her."
"Bloody old crumb," I said indignant.
"Well, he's no the flower of gallantry," Jamie agreed.
He poured out a basin of water and began to splash handfuls over his face. He looked up, startled and streaming, at my gasp.
"Huh?"
"Your stomach," I said, pointing.
The skin between breastbone and kilt was mottled with a large fresh bruise, spreading like a large unsightly blossom on his fair skin. Jamie glanced down, said,
"Oh, that,"
dismissively, and returned to his washing.
"Yes, that,"
I said, coming to take a closer look. "What happened?"
"It's no matter," he said, speech coming thickly through a towel. "I spoke a bit hasty this afternoon, and my grandsire had young Simon give me a small lesson in respect."
"So he had a couple of minor phrases hold you while he punched you in the belly," I said, feeling slightly ill.
Tossing the towel aside, Jamie reached for his nightshirt.
"Very flattering of you to suppose it took two to hold me," he said, grinning as his head popped through the opening. "Actually, there were three. One was behind, choking me."
"Jamie!"
He laughed, shaking his head ruefully as he pulled back the quilt on the bed.
"I don't know what it is about you, Sassenach, that always makes me want to show off for you. Get myself killed one of these days trying to impress you, I expect."
He sighed, gingerly smoothing the woolen shirt over his stomach.
"It's only play-acting, Sassenach. You shouldn't worry."
"Play-acting? Good God, Jamie.
Have you no seen a strange dog join a pack, Sassenach? The others sniff at him and nip at his legs and growl to see will he cower or growl back at them. And sometimes it comes to biting and sometimes not. But at the end of it, every dog in the pack knows his place and who's leader. Old Simon wants to be sure I ken who leads this pack, that's all."
"Oh? And do you?"
I lay down, waiting for him to come to bed. He picked up the candle and grinned down at me, the flickering light picking up a blue gleam in his eyes.
"Woof,"
he said, and blew out the candle. I saw very little of Jamie for the next 2 weeks, save at night. During the day, he was always with his grandfather, hunting or riding, for Lovett was a vigorous man, despite his age, or drinking in the study, as the old fox slowly drew his conclusions and laid his plans. I spent most of my time with Frances and the other women. Out of the shadow of her redoubtable old father, Frances gained enough courage to speak her own mind and proved an intelligent and interesting companion. She had the responsibility for the smooth running of the castle and its staff, but when her father appeared on the scene, she dwindled into insignificance, seldom raising her eyes or speaking above a whisper. I wasn't sure I blamed her. 2 weeks after our arrival, Jamie came to fetch me from the drawing-room where I sat with Frances and Aileen, saying that Lord Lovett wished to see me. Old Simon waved a casual hand at the decanters set on the table by the wall, then sat down in a wide-seated chair of carved walnut with crushed padding in well-worn blue velvet. The chair fitted his short, stocky form as though it had been built around him. I wondered whether it had, in fact, been built to order, or whether, from long use, he had grown into the shape of the chair. I sat down quietly in the corner with my glass of port, and kept quiet while Simon questioned Jamie once again about Charles Stuart's situation and prospects. For the 20th time in a week, Jamie patiently rehearsed the number of troops available, the structure of command, insofar as one existed, the armament on hand, and its condition, mostly poor, the prospects of Charles being joined by Lord Lewis Gordon or the Farquharsons, what Glengarry had said following Prestonpans, what Cameron knew or deduced of the movement of English troops, why Charles had decided to march south, and so on and so forth. I found myself nodding over the cup in my hand and jerked myself into wakefulness just in time to keep the ruby liquid from tipping onto my skirt.
"And Lord George Murray and Kilmarnock both think His Highness would be best advised to pull back into the Highlands for the winter,"
Jamie concluded, yawning widely. Cramped on the narrow-backed chair he had been given, he rose and stretched, his shadow flickering on the pale hangings that covered the stone walls.
And what do you think yourself?
Old Simon's eyes glittered under half-fallen lids as he leaned back in his chair. The fire burned high and bright on the hearth. Francis had smoured the fire in the main hall, covering it with peats. This one had been rekindled at Lovett's order, and with wood, not peat. The smell of pine resin from the burning wood was sharp, mingled with the thicker smell of smoke. The light cast Jamie's shadow high on the wall as he turned restlessly, not wanting to sit down again. It was close and dark in the small study, with the window draped against the night, very different from the open, sunny kirkyard in which Colum had asked him the same question. And the situation now had shifted. No longer the popular darling to whom clan chieftains deferred, Charles now was sending to the chiefs, grimly calling in his obligations. But the shape of the problem was the same, a dark, amorphous shape hanging like a shadow over us.
"I've told you what I think, a dozen times or more."
Jamie spoke abruptly. He moved his shoulders impatiently, shrugging as though the fit of his coat was too tight.
"Oh, aye, you've told me. But this time I think we shall have the truth."
The old man settled more comfortably into his padded chair, hands linked across his belly.
"Will you, then?"
Jamie uttered a short laugh and turned to face his grandfather. He leaned back against the table, hands braced behind him. Despite the differences in posture and figure, there was a tension between the two men that brought out a fugitive resemblance between them. The one tall and the other squat, but both of them strong, stubborn, and determined to win this encounter.
"Am I not your kinsman and your chief? I command your loyalty, do I not?"
So that was the point. Colum, so accustomed to physical weakness, had known the secret of turning another man's weakness to his own purposes. Simon Fraser, strong and vigorous even in old age, was accustomed to getting his own way by more direct means. I could see from the sour smile on Jamie's face that he too was contrasting Colum's appeal with his grandfather's demand.
"Can ye? I dinna recall that I've sworn ye an oath."
Several long stiff hairs grew out of Simon's eyebrows, in the way of old men. These quivered in the firelight. Oh, I couldn't tell whether with indignation or amusement.
"Oath, is it? And is it not Fraser blood in your veins?"
Jamie's mouth twisted wryly as he answered.
"They do say that it's a wise child as kens his own father, no? My mother was a Mackenzie. I know that much."
Simon's face grew dark with blood and his brows drew together. Then his mouth fell open, and he shouted with laughter. He laughed until he was forced to pull himself up in the chair and bend forward, sputtering and choking. At last, beating one hand on the arm of the chair in helpless mirth, he reached into his mouth with the other and pulled out his false teeth.
"God!"
he sputtered, gasping and wheezing. Face streaming with tears and saliva, he groped blindly for the small table by his chair and dropped the teeth onto the cake plate. The gnarled fingers closed on a linen napkin, and he pressed it to his face, still emitting strangled grunts of laughter as he conducted his mopping up.
"Christ, laddie," he said at last, lisping heavily. "Pass me the whiskey."
Eyebrows raised, Jamie took the decanter from the table behind him and passed it to his grandfather, who removed the stopper and gulped a substantial amount of the contents without bothering about the formality of a glass.
"You think you're not a Fraser?" he said, lowering the decanter and exhaling gustily. "Ha!"
He leaned back once more, belly rising and falling rapidly as he caught his breath. He pointed a long, skinny finger at Jamie.
"Your own father stood right where you're standing, laddie, and told me just what you did the day he left Beaufort Castle once and for all."
The old man was growing calmer now. He coughed several times and wiped his face again.
Did you know that I tried to stop your parents' marriage by claiming that Ellen Mackenzie's child wasn't Brian's? Aye, I knew.
Jamie was leaning back on the table again, surveying his grandfather through narrowed eyes. Lord Lovett snorted.
I'll not say that there's always been goodwill between me and mine, but I know my sons. And my grandsons, he added pointedly. Deal take me, and I think any one of them could be a cuckold, nay, more than I could.
Jamie didn't turn a hair, but I couldn't stop myself from glancing away from the old man. I found myself staring at his discarded teeth, the stained beechwood gleaming wetly amid the cake crumbs. Luckily, Lord Lovett hadn't noticed my slight motion. He went on, serious once more.
Now then, Dougal Mackenzie of Lennox hath declared for Charles. You call him your chief. Is that what you're telling me? That ye've given him an oath? No, I've not sworn to anyone. Not even Charles.
The old man was fast, pouncing on this like a cat on a mouse. I could almost see his tail twitch as he watched Jamie, slanted eyes deep set and gleaming under crepey lids. Jamie's eyes were fixed on the leaping flames, his shadow motionless on the wall behind him.
He hasn't asked me.
This was true. Charles had had no need to request an oath from Jamie, having precluded the necessity by signing Jamie's name to his bond of association. Still, I knew that the fact that he hadn't given his word to Charles was important to Jamie. If he must betray the man, let it not be as an acknowledged chief. The idea that the entire world thought such an oath existed was a matter of much less concern. Simon grunted again. Without his false teeth, his nose and chin came close together, making the lower half of his face oddly foreshortened.
"Then nothing hampers you to swear to me as chief of your clan," he said quietly.
The twitching tail was less visible, but still there. I could almost hear the thoughts in his head gliding round on padded feet. With Jamie's loyalty sworn to him rather than Charles, Lovett's power would be increased, as would his wealth, with a share of the income from Lallybroch that he might claim as his chieftain's due. The prospect of a dukedom drew slightly nearer, gleaming through the mist.
"Nothing, save my own will," Jamie agreed pleasantly. "But that's some small obstacle, no?"
His own eyes creased at the corners as they narrowed further.
"Mm-hmm."
Lovett's eyes were almost closed, and he shook his head slowly from side to side.
"Oh, aye, lad, you're your father's son, stubborn as a block, and twice as stupid. I should have known that Brian would sire nothing but fools from that harlot."
Jamie reached forward and plucked the beechwood teeth from the plate.
"You'd better put these back, you old gomeral," he said rudely. "I cannot understand a word you say."
His grandfather's mouth widened in a humourless smile that showed the yellowed stump of a lone broken tooth in the lower jaw.
"No," he said. "Will you understand the bargain?"
He shot a quick look at me, seeing nothing more than another counter to be put into play.
"Your oath for your wife's honour. How's that?"
Jamie laughed out loud, still holding the teeth in one hand.
"Oh, aye. Do you mean to force her before my eyes, then, grandsire?"
He lounged back contemptuously, hand on the table.
"Go ahead. And when she's done with you, I'll send Aunt Frances up to sweep up the pieces."
His grandfather looked him over calmly.
"Not I, lad."
One side of the toothless mouth rose in a lopsided smile as he turned his head to look at me.
"Though I've taken my pleasure with worth."
The cold malice in the dark eyes made me want to pull my cloak over my breasts in protection. Unfortunately, I wasn't wearing one.
How many men are there in Beaufort, Jimmy? How many could be of a mind to put your Fastenach wench to the only youth she's good for? You cannot guard her night and day.
Jamie straightened slowly, the great shadow echoing his movements on the wall. He stared down at his grandfather with no expression on his face.
"Oh, I think I need no worry, grandsire," he said softly, "for my wife's a rare woman. A wise woman, you ken. A white lady, like Dame Alicet."
I'd never heard of Dame Alicet, but Lord Lovat plainly had. His head jerked round to stare at me, eyes sprung wide with shocked alarm. His mouth drooped open, but before he could speak, Jamie had gone on, an undercurrent of malice clearly audible in his smooth speech.
"The man that takes her in unholy embrace will have its privates blasted like a frost-bitten apple," he said with relish, "and his soul will burn forever in hell."
He bared his teeth at his grandfather and drew back his hand.
"Like this?"
The beechwood teeth landed in the midst of the fire with a plop, and at once began to sizzle. Chapter 41 The Seer's Curse. Most of the Lowland Scots had gone over to Presbyterianism in the 2 centuries before. Some of the Highland clans had gone with them, but others, like the Frasers and Mackenzies, had kept their Catholic faith. Especially the Frasers, with their strong family ties to Catholic France. There was a small chapel in Beaufort Castle to serve the devotional uses of the Earl and his family, but Bewley Priory, ruined as it was, remained the burying place of the Lovats, and the floor of the open-roofed chancel was paved thick with the flat tombstones of those who lay under them. It was a peaceful place, and I walked there sometimes, in spite of the cold, blustery weather. I had no idea whether old Simon had meant his threat against me, or whether Jamie's comparing me to Dame Alicet, who turned out to be a legendary white woman or healer, the Scottish equivalent of La Dame Blanche, was sufficient to put a stop to that threat. But I thought that no one was likely to accost me among the tombs of extinct Frasers. One afternoon, a few days after the scene in the study, I walked through a gap in the ruined priory wall and found that, for once, I didn't have it to myself. The tall woman I had seen outside Lovett's study was there, leaning against one of the red stone tombs, arms folded about her for warmth, long legs thrust out like a stork. I made to turn aside, but she saw me and motioned me to join her.
"You'll be my Lady Brochturach," she said,
though there was no more than a hint of question in her soft Highland voice.
"I am. And you're Masri?"
A small smile lit her face. She had a most intriguing face, slightly asymmetrical, like a Modigliani painting, and long black hair that flowed loose around her shoulders, streaked with white, though she was plainly still young.
"A seer, hmm? I thought she looked the part."
I have the sight," she said, the smile widening a bit on her lopsided mouth.
"Do mind-reading too, do you?" I asked.
She laughed, the sound vanishing on the wind that moaned through the ruined walls.
"No, lady, but I do read faces, and..."
"And mine's an open book, I know," I said, resigned. We stood side by side for a time then, watching tiny spatters of fine sleet dashing against the sandstone and the thick brown grass that overgrew the kirkyard.
"They do say as you're a white lady,"
Masri observed suddenly. I could feel her watching me intently, but with none of the nervousness that seemed common to such an observation.
"They do say that," I agreed.
"Ah." She didn't speak again, just stared down at her feet. Long and elegant, stockinged in wool and clad in leather sandals.
My own toes, rather more sheltered, were growing numb, and I thought hers must be frozen solid if she'd been here any time. "What are you doing up here?" I asked. The Priory was a beautiful, peaceful place in good weather, but not much of a roost in the cold winter sleet.
"I come here to think," she said.
She gave me a slight smile, but was plainly preoccupied. Whatever she was thinking, her thoughts weren't overly pleasant.
"To think about what?"
I asked, hoisting myself up to sit on the tomb beside her. The worn figure of a knight lay on the lid, his claymore clasped to his bosom, the hilt forming a cross over his heart.
"I want to know why," she burst out.
Her thin face was suddenly alight with indignation.
"Why what? Why? Why can I see what will happen when there's no mortal thing I can be doing to change it or stop it? What's the good of a gift like that? It's no a gift come to that. It's a damn curse, though I haven't done anything to be cursed like this."
She turned and glared balefully at Thomas Fraser, serene under his helm, with the hilt of his sword clasped under crossed hands.
"Aye, and maybe it's your curse, you old Gomeril, you and the rest of your damned family. Did you ever think that?" she asked suddenly, turning to me.
Her brows arched high over brown eyes that sparked with furious intelligence.
"Did you ever think, perhaps, that it's no your own fate at all that makes you what you are? That maybe you have the sight or the power only because it's necessary to someone else, and it's nothing to do with you at all, except that it's you has it, and has to suffer the having of it. Have you?"
"I don't know," I said slowly. "Or, yes, since you say it, I have wondered. Why me? You ask that all the time, of course, but I've never come up with a satisfactory answer. You think, perhaps, you have the sight because it's a curse on the Frasers to know their deaths ahead of time. That's a hell of an idea."
"A hell is right," she agreed bitterly.
She leaned back against the sarcophagus of red stone, staring out at the sleet that sprayed across the top of the broken wall.
"What do you think?" she asked suddenly. "Do I tell him?"
I was startled.
"Who?"
"Lord Lovat."
"Aye, his lordship. He asks what I see and beats me when I tell him there's naught to see. He knows you can. He sees it in my face when I've had the sight. But that's the only power I've got, the power not to see."
The long white fingers snaked out from her cloak, playing nervously with the folds of soaked cloth.
"There's always the chance of it, isn't there?" she said.
Her head was bent so that the hood of her cloak shielded her face from my gaze.
"There's a chance that my telling would make a difference. It has, now and then, you know. I told Lachlan Gibbons when I saw his son-in-law wrapped in seaweed and the eels stirring beneath his shirt. Lachlan listened. He went out straight away and stove a hole in his son-in-law's boat."
She laughed, remembering.
"Lord, there was the kebby-lebby to do. But when the great storm came the next week, three men were drowned, and Lachlan's son-in-law was safe at home, still mending his boat. And when I saw him next, his shirt hung dry on him, and the seaweed was gone from his hair."
"So it can happen," I said softly. "Sometimes."
"Sometimes,"
she said, nodding, still staring at the ground. Lady Sarah Fraser lay at her feet, the lady's stone surmounted with a skull atop crossed bones. "Hodie mihi cras tibi," said the inscription. "Sic transit gloria mundi. My turn today, yours tomorrow. And thus passes away the glory of the world."
"Sometimes not. When I see a man wrapped in his winding sheet, the illness follows, and there's naught to be done about that."
"Perhaps," I said. I looked at my own hand spread on the stone beside me. "Without medicine,
without instruments, without knowledge, yes, then illness was fate and naught to be done. But if a healer was near and had the things to heal with, was it possible that Masri saw the shadow of a coming illness as a real, if usually invisible, symptom, much like a fever or a rash? And then, only the lack of medical facilities made the reading of such symptoms a sentence of death. I would never know. We aren't ever going to know, I said, turning to her. We can't say. We know things that other people don't know, and we can't say why or how. But we have got it, and you're right. It's a curse. But if you have knowledge, and it may prevent harm, do you think it could cause harm? She shook her head. I cannot see. If you knew you were to die soon, are the things you'd do? And would they be good things only that you'd do? Or would you take that last chance you might have to do harm to your enemies? Harm that might otherwise be left alone?
Damned if I know.
We were quiet for a time, watching the sleet turn to snow, and the blowing flakes whirl up in gusts through the ruined tracery of the priory wall. Sometimes I know there's something there, like, Masri said suddenly. But I can block it out of my mind, not Luke. 'Twas like that with his lordship. I knew there was something, but I'd managed not to see it. But then he bade me look, and say the divining spell to make the vision come clear. And I did. The hood of her cloak slipped back as she tilted her head, looking up at the wall of the priory as it soared above us, ochre and white and red, with the mortar crumbling between its stones. White-streaked black hair spilled down her back, free in the wind. He was standing there before the fire, but it was daylight and clear to see. A man stood behind him, still as a tree, and his face covered in black. And across his lordship's face there fell the shadow of an axe. She spoke matter-of-factly, but the shiver ran up my spine nonetheless. She sighed at last and turned to me. Well, I will tell him then, and let him do what he will. Doom him or save him, that I cannot do. It's his choice, and the Lord Jesus help him. She turned to go, and I slid off the tomb, landing on the Lady Sarah's slab. Masri, I said. She turned back to look at me, eyes black as the shadows among the tombs. Aye. What do you see, Masri? I asked, and stood waiting, facing her, hands dropped to my sides. She stared at me hard, above and below, behind and beside. At last she smiled faintly, nodding. I see naught but you, lady, she said softly. There's only you. She turned and disappeared down the path between the trees, leaving me among the blowing flakes of snow. Doom or save? That I cannot do, for I have no power beyond that of knowledge, no ability to bend others to my will, no way to stop them doing what they will. There is only me. I shook the snow from the folds of my cloak and turned to follow Masri down the path, sharing her bitter knowledge that there was only me, and I was not enough. Old Simon's manner was much as usual over the course of the next 2 or 3 weeks, but I imagined that Masri had kept her intention of telling him about her visions. While he had seemed on the verge of summoning the taxmen and tenants to march, suddenly he backed off, saying that there was no hurry after all. This shilly-shallying infuriated young Simon, who was champing at the bit to go to war and cover himself with glory.
"It's not a matter of urgency," old Simon said for the dozenth time.
He lifted an oatcake, sniffed at it, and set it down again.
Perhaps we'll do best to wait for the spring planting after all.
They could be in London before spring. Young Simon glowered across the dinner table at his father and reached for the butter. If you will not go yourself, then let me take the men to join His Highness.
Lord Lovat grunted.
You've the devil's own impatience, he said, but not half his judgment. Will ye never learn to wait?
The time for waiting's long since past, Simon burst out. The Camerons, the MacDonalds, the McGilverys, they've all been there since the first. Are we to come meeching along at the finish to find ourselves beggars and taking second place to Clanranald and Glengarry? Fat chance you'll have of a dukedom then.
Lovat had a wide, expressive mouth. Even in old age it retained some trace of humour and sensuality. Neither was visible at the moment. He pressed his lips tight together, surveying his heir without enthusiasm.
"Marry in haste, repent at leisure," he said. "And it's more true when choosing a laird than a lass. A woman can be got rid of."
Young Simon snorted and looked at Jamie for support. Over the last 2 months, his initial suspicious hostility had faded into a reluctant respect for his bastard relative's obvious expertise in the art of war.
"Jamie says," he began. "I ken well enough what he says," old Simon interrupted. "He said it often enough. I shall make up my own mind in my own time. But bear it in mind, lad. When it comes to declaring yourself in a war, there's little to be lost by waiting." "Waiting to see who wins," Jamie murmured, studiously wiping his plate with a bit of bread.
The old man looked up sharply, but evidently decided to ignore this contribution.
"You gave your word to the Stuarts," young Simon continued stubbornly, paying no heed to his father's displeasure. "You dinna mean to break it, surely. What will people say of your honour?" "The same things they said in 15, his father calmly replied. "Most of those who said things then are dead, bankrupt, or paupers in France. But I am still here. But..."
Young Simon was red in the face, the usual result of this sort of conversation with his father.
"That will do," the old earl interrupted sharply.
He shook his head as he glared at his son, lips tight with disapproval.
"Christ! Sometimes I could wish that Brian hadna died. He may have been a fool too, but at least he knew when to stop talking."
Both young Simon and Jamie flushed with anger, but after a wary glance at each other, turned their attentions to their food.
"And what are you looking at?"
Lord Lovat growled, catching my eye on him as he turned away from his son.
"You," I said bluntly. "You don't look at all well."
He didn't, even for a man in his 70s. No more than middle height, slumped and broadened by age, he was normally still a solid-looking man, giving the impression that his barrel chest and rounded paunch were firm and healthy under his linen. Lately he'd begun to look flabby, though, as if he'd shrunk a bit within his skin. The wrinkled bags beneath his eyes were darkened, and his skin had a sickly pallor to it.
"Mm-hmm," he grunted. "And why not? I get nae rest when I sleep, nor comfort when I'm awake. No wonder if I dinna look like a bridegroom."
"Oh, but you do, father,"
said young Simon maliciously, seeing a chance to get a bit of his own back.
"One at the end of his honeymoon, we all the juice sapped out of him."
"Simon," said Lady Frances.
Still, there was a ripple of laughter around the table at this, and even Lord Lovat's mouth twitched slightly.
"Aye," he said. "Well, I'd sooner suffer soreness from that cause, I'll tell you, lad."
He shifted uncomfortably in his seat, and pushed away the platter of boiled turnips being offered. He reached for his wine glass, raised it to his nose for a sniff, then morosely put it down again.
"It's ill-mannered to stare," he remarked coldly to me, "or perhaps the English have different standards of politeness."
I flushed slightly, but didn't drop my eyes. "I was just wondering. You don't have an appetite, and you don't drink. What other symptoms have you?"
going to prove yourself some worthy.
Lovett leaned back in his chair, folding his hands across his broad stomach like an elderly frog.
A healer, my grandson says. A white lady, aye?
He flicked a basilisk glance at Jamie, who simply went on eating, ignoring his grandfather. Lovett grunted and tilted his head ironically in my direction.
Well, I dinna drink, lady, for a can of piss, and a little wish to blow up like a pig's bladder. And I dinna rest, for I rise a dozen times a night to make use of my pot, and damn little use it gets. So, what have ye to say to that, Dame Alicet?
Father, murmured Lady Frances, really, I don't think you should...
Could be an infection of the bladder, but it sounds like prostatitis to me, I replied. I picked up my wine glass and took a mouthful, savouring it before letting it slide down my throat. I smiled demurely at his lordship across my glass as I set it down.
Oh, it does, he said,
eyebrows raised high.
And what's that, pray?
I pushed back my sleeves and raised my hands, flexing my fingers like a magician about to perform some act of prestidigitation. I held up my left forefinger. The prostate gland in males, I said instructively, encircles the tube of the urethra, which is the passage that leads from the bladder to the outside. I clasped two fingers of my right hand in a circle around my left forefinger in illustration. When the prostate becomes inflamed or enlarged, and that's called prostatitis when it does, it clamps down on the urethra. I narrowed the circle of my fingers, cutting off the flow of urine. Very common in older men, do you see? Lady Frances, failing to make any impression on her father with her opinions of proper dinner conversation, was whispering agitatedly to her younger sister, both of them watching me with deeper suspicion than usual. Lord Lovett watched my little demonstration in fascination.
"Aye, I see," he said.
The slanted cat eyes narrowed, looking speculatively at my fingers.
"What's to do about it, then, if you're so much learning on the subject?"
I thought, frowning as I searched my memory. I'd never actually seen, much less treated, a case of prostatitis, as it wasn't a condition that much afflicted young soldiers. Still, I had read medical texts where it was described. I remembered the treatment because it had caused such hilarity among the student nurses, who had pored in fascinated horror over the rather graphic illustrations in the text. "Well," I said, "barring surgery, there are really only two things you can do. You can insert a metal rod through the penis and up into the bladder to force the urethra open." I jabbed my forefinger through the constricting circle. "Or you can massage the prostate itself to reduce the swelling." "Through the rectum," I added helpfully. I heard a faint choking noise next to me and glanced up at Jamie. His eyes were still fixed on his plate, but the tide of crimson was creeping upward from his collar, and the tips of his ears blazed red. He quivered slightly. I looked around the table to find a phalanx of fascinated gazes fixed on me. The Lady Frances, Aileen, and the other women were staring at me with varying expressions, ranging from curiosity to disgust, while the men all wore variations of revolted horror. The exception to the general reaction was Lord Lovett himself, who was rubbing his chin thoughtfully, eyes half-closed.
"Mm-hmm," he said. "Hell of a choice there. A stick up the cock or a finger up the backside, eh?"
"More like two or three," I said, repeatedly.
I gave him a small, decorous smile.
"Ah."
A similar small smile decorated Lord Lovett's mouth, and he slowly lifted his gaze, fixing deep blue eyes on mine with an expression of mockery tinged with challenge.
"That sounds diverting," he observed mildly.
The slanted eyes slid down over my hands, assessing.
"You've lovely hands, my dear," he said. "Prettily kept, and such long, white, slender fingers, eh?"
Jamie brought both his own hands down on the table with a crash and stood up. He leaned across the table, bringing his face within a foot of his grandfather's.
"And you're needing such attentions, grandsire," he said. "I'll see to it myself."
He spread out his hands on the tabletop, broad and massive, each long finger the rough diameter of a pistol barrel.
"It's no pleasure to me to be sticking my fingers up your hairy old ass," he informed his grandfather, "but I expect it's my filial duty to save you from exploding in a shower of piss. No?"
Francis emitted a faint squeak. Lord Lovett eyed his grandson with considerable disfavour, then rose slowly from his seat.
"Don't trouble yourself," he said shortly. "I'll hae one of the maidservants do it."
He waved a hand at the company, giving notice that we might continue the meal, and left the hall, pausing to look speculatively at a young serving girl coming in with a platter of sliced pheasant. Eyes wide, she turned sideways to edge past him. There was a dead silence over the dinner table following his lordship's exit. Young Simon looked at me and opened his mouth. Then he glanced at Jamie and closed it again. He cleared his throat.
"I'll have the salt, if you please," he said. "And in consequence of the regrettable infirmity that prevents me from personal attendance upon your highness, I send by the hand of my son and heir a token of the loyalty, nay, make that regard, a token of the regard in which I have long cherished his majesty and your highness."
Lord Lovett paused, frowning at the ceiling.
"What shall we send, Gideon?" he asked the secretary. "Rich looking, but not so much I can't say it was only a trifling present of no importance."
Gideon sighed and wiped his face with a handkerchief. A stout, middle-aged man with thinning hair and round red cheeks, he plainly found the heat of the bedroom fire oppressive.
"The ring your lordship had from the Earl of Mar," he suggested, without hope.
A drop of sweat fell from his double chin onto the letter he was taking down, and he surreptitiously blotted it with his sleeve.
"Not expensive enough," his lordship judged, "and too many political associations."
The mottled fingers tapped pensively on the coverlet as he thought. Old Simon had done it up brown, I thought. He was wearing his best nightshirt, and was propped up in bed with an impressive panoply of medicines arrayed on the table, attended by his personal physician, Dr. Mingus, a small man with a squint, who kept eyeing me with considerable doubt. I suppose the old man simply distrusted young Simon's powers of imagination, and had staged this elaborate tableau so that his heir might faithfully report Lord Lovett's state of decrepitude when he presented himself to Charles Stuart.
"Ah," said his lordship with satisfaction, "we'll send the gold and sterling picnic set. That's rich enough, but too frivolous to be interpreted as political support. Besides," he added practically, "the spoon's dented." "All right, then," he said to the secretary. "Let's go on with, as your highness is aware."
I exchanged a glance with Jamie, who hid a smile in response.
"I think you've given him what he needs, Sassenach,"
he had told me as we undressed after our fateful dinner the week before. "And what's that?" I asked. "An excuse to molest the maidservants?"
"I doubt he bothers greatly with excuses of that sort,"
Jamie said dryly.
"Nay, you've given him a way to walk both sides, as usual. If he's got an impressive-sounding disease that keeps him to his bed, then he canna be blamed for not appearing himself with the men he promised. At the same time, if he sends his heir to fight, the Stuarts will credit Lovett with keeping his promise. And if it goes wrong, the old fox will claim to the English that he didn't intend to give any aid to the Stuarts, but young Simon went on his own account." Spell prostatitis for Gideon, would you, lass?
Lord Lovick called to me, breaking into my thoughts.
And mind you write it out carefully, Clot, he said to his secretary. I dinna want His Highness to misread it.
P-R-O-S-T-A-T-I-T-I-S. I spelled slowly, for Gideon's benefit. And how is it this morning, anyway? I asked, coming to stand by his lordship's bedside.
Greatly improved, I thank ye,
the old man said, grinning up at me with a fine display of false teeth.
Want to see me piss?
Not just now, thanks, I said politely. It was a clear, icy day in mid-December when we left Bewley to join Charles Stuart and the Highland Army. Against all advice, Charles had pressed on into England, defying weather and common sense, as well as his generals. But at last, in Derby, the generals had prevailed, the Highland chiefs refusing to go farther, and the Highland Army was returning northward. An urgent letter from Charles to Jamie had urged us to head south without delay, to rendezvous with His Highness upon his return to Edinburgh. Young Simon, looking every inch the clan chieftain in his crimson tartan, rode at the head of a column of men. Those men with mounts followed him, while the larger number on foot walked behind. Being mounted, we rode with Simon at the head of the column until such time as we would reach Comar. There we would part company, Simon and the Fraser troops to go to Edinburgh, Jamie ostensibly escorting me to Lallybroch before returning to Edinburgh himself. He had, of course, no intention of so returning, but that was none of Simon's business. At mid-morning, I emerged from a small wooded clump by the side of the track to find Jamie waiting impatiently. Hot ale had been served to the departing men to hearten them for the journey, and while I had myself found that hot ale made a surprisingly good breakfast, I'd also found it had a marked effect on the kidneys. Jamie snorted.
Women, he said. How can you all take such a devil of a time to do such a simple thing as piss? You make as much fuss over it as my grandsire.
Well, you can come along next time and watch, I suggested acerbically. Perhaps you'll have some helpful suggestions. He merely snorted again and turned back to watch the column of men filing past, but he was smiling nonetheless. The clear, bright day raised everyone's spirits, but Jamie was in a particularly good mood this morning. And no wonder. We were going home. I knew he didn't deceive himself that all would be well. This war would have its price. But if we had failed to stop Charles, it might still be that we could save the small corner of Scotland that lay closest to us, Lallybroch. That much might still be within our power. I glanced at the trailing column of clansmen. 200 men make a fair show.
170,
Jamie corrected absently, reaching for his horse's reins. Are you sure? I asked curiously. Lord Lovett said he was sending 200. I heard him dictating the letter saying so.
Well, he didn't.
Jamie swung into the saddle, then stood up in his stirrups, pointing down the slope ahead, to the distant spot where the Fraser banner with its stag's head crest fluttered at the head of the column.
"I counted them while I waited for you," he explained. 30 cavalry up there with Simon, then 50 with broadswords and targes. Those will be the men from the local watch. And then the cotters, with everything from scythes to hammers at their belts, and there's 90 of those."
I suppose your grandfather's betting on Prince Charles, not counting them personally, I observed cynically, trying to get credit for more than he's sent.
Aye, but the names will be entered on the army rolls when they reach Edinburgh, Jamie said, frowning. I'd best see.
I followed more sedately. I judged my mount to be approximately 20 years old and capable of no more than a staid amble. Jamie's mount was a trifle friskier, though still no match for Donus. The huge stallion had been left in Edinburgh,
as Prince Charles wished to ride him on public occasions. Jamie had acceded to this request, as he harboured suspicions that old Simon might well be capable of appropriating the big horse, should donors come within